welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. It is Monday, November 13th, 2017, and we are here to recap Week 10 of the National Football League season. An interesting week, a bunch of injuries, especially in that Thursday night game, but we're going to talk about four games from Sunday, and joining me to do that is ESPN's Kevin Seifert. Kevin, how are you?
I'm very good, Bill. Thanks for having me.
I am always happy to have you on. Of course, you are someone who you cover the league as a whole, but in a past life, I suppose, you were focusing on the Minnesota Vikings. And so, given that they're one of the best teams in football right now, I think we should start there with the 7-2 Vikings, who did head to Washington and come away with a road win on Sunday, 38-30. Got a little thorny there at the end. I think the game was not quite as close as the final score might indicate, given that, Washington did kick a field goal with 1:14 left to make it an 8-point game. But let's start with Case Keenum, who I think it's fair to ask, is he actually really good?
I mean, he has played very well. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And having seen a fair bit of his career up till this point, on a relative scale, he's playing out of his mind. Mm-hmm. He has been very accurate, very good at finding open receivers. I know both of those things sound like simple tasks for a quarterback, but we know we don't always see that. He's mobile enough and willing to move around in the pocket enough that he's allowed receivers to adjust and get open in cases where they initially were not. And he's very much in lockstep with Pat Shurmur, the Vikings offensive coordinator, in terms of knowing what is coming and knowing how to execute the calls and knowing when to audible and all those sorts of things. So at the beginning of the season, I think most Vikings fans would have grimaced to think that the season was in any way in the hands of Case Keenum. And now he's at the played to the point where it's certainly not a no-brainer that they should go to Teddy Bridgewater, and arguably a mistake for them to go to Teddy Bridgewater, even though he's now healthy.
Yeah, it does seem like this is the best possible case for, I guess that was not a pun I meant on purpose, I swear. but it is like a really positive scenario when it comes to using Case Keenum. And I think, you know, traditional numbers do understate his value. He's, I believe, 14th or so in passer rating this year, but he's third in total QBR, which I mm-hmm. granted, I don't think he's actually better than Carson Wentz or Tom Brady, who he's just ahead of in the QBR rankings, but does speak to how he remains effective. He hasn't fumbled once this year, which even your best quarterbacks in the league are going to fumble four or five times over the course of the year due to sacks. He doesn't take any sacks. I think he has 5 sacks all season so
right.
far. Wasn't sacked once on Sunday. So he's not putting the team in bad situations, and he hasn't turned the ball over all that frequently. Now, granted, I'm saying this after he had 2 really ugly interceptions in the fourth quarter of this game. So, I mean, he did struggle towards the end of it, but, I mean, his overall numbers, even with the 2 picks, he posted a 117 passer rating. He was 21 of 29 for 304 yards and 4 touchdowns, and it wasn't like those passes were all screens. I mean, he was chucking up and making big plays to Stephon Diggs early on, past Josh Norman. Adam Thielen had a great game, and at least one, if not more, really big play downfield for Thielen. And it's not as if those guys were necessarily great receivers last year. You know, they had great stretches last year with Sam Bradford, but they weren't consistently looking like the players they look like right now under Case Keenum. So let me ask you, Kevin, I mean, do you think, in terms of the Teddy Bridgewater situation, how long is Case Keenum's leash at this point?
You know, it's weird. There's undeniably an emotional tie between Teddy Bridgewater and Mike Zimmer that is mm-hmm. going to play a factor here. And I think, you know, what is Case Keenum's leash? It's game to game. If he keeps playing like he did yesterday, I don't think it can be a question. But the way it'll probably manifest is that there'll be an awfully short, quick trigger on him if he has a bad game or if they fall behind because of some mistakes that he's made. I think it's entirely possible to see him get pulled in a situation where you would not otherwise see it. You know, you would see a coach give the quarterback who has played so well to this point a little bit more leash. So I think he's on the shortest leash you can possibly be when you're a top 5 QBR, even a top 10 QBR quarterback. There's really no rational way you could justify benching him at this point, based on how he's played, even with the interceptions yesterday. But the conventional wisdom is at some point Case Keenum will be Case Keenum, and he'll mm-hmm. have a really inaccurate game, or he'll throw a bunch of interceptions that actually cost you a game, and that'll open up the door for Teddy, where otherwise it probably would have meant, you know, well, hopefully he'll recover from it and, you know, you're not going to play great every week. So I think the first time he doesn't play to the level he's played to this point is the point at which you see Teddy in the game.
It does seem unfair, though. I mean, he's playing really well.
Yeah.
And granted, I mean, he's certainly going to have a hefty raise, you would figure, this offseason on what he's making, $2 million or so this year,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
That's never
what a great bargain, yeah.
Really good deal. I mean, do you think he has a viable shot at starting somewhere next year?
Yeah, I think at the very least, and why Case, you know, I'm sure if he gets benched, he'd be crushed, and I totally would get that. But I think at the very least what has happened here is that he has pulled himself from that tier of, you know, veteran backup quarterbacks who wouldn't be embarrassed to put on the field if it came to that point, to one where could be a backup, but very well could be your starter if your options are limited. I mean, if the Bears were willing to take a jump on, or take a risk on Mike Glennon for a year at big money, then maybe somebody at about the same age or maybe a few years older, Case Keenum, I think he's 29, would be willing to say, hey, you know, we could do a lot worse than Case Keenum. We'll pay him $12, $14 million or whatever, maybe more to be our starter while we try to figure things out. I think he's absolutely pulled himself up in from that previous tier to that point where a team would, I think, you know, it wouldn't be a top level team, but certainly a team that has either had an injury or a retirement or didn't get what they wanted in the draft or all the above could very comfortably think that he'd be worth, you know, what's that, 8 figures salary to be a starter, at least in the short term.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a guy who, like you said, $2 million this year, I think $3.6 million from the Rams a year ago. I mean, he's certainly elevated his game dramatically no matter what happens, I think, from this point forward. The running game wasn't very effective for the Vikings here. They did split Jerick McKinnon and Latavius Murray basically 50-50. And do you think that's sort of how they want it to be over the rest of the season?
You know, over time, yes, but I could see them being a little bit like the Patriots in their backfield in deciding which running back to use based on how they think the matchup with the opposing defense is. Do they think they, because there are two different styles there. Latavius Murray has some speed and some moves, but he's more of an off tackle guy than Jerick McKinnon, who is, you can do a lot of different things with, but maybe isn't a guy you want to hand, still don't want to hand to him 20 times off tackle and over the course of a game. So I could see it switching and varying. They're both going to play every game, but I could see the emphasis switching and varying depending on how opposing defenses are judged to be matched up with their offense. And so that neither one of them have performed in a way that you say, well, this guy clearly should be the starter, or this guy clearly should get the majority of carries in both games. And so they have that luxury slash disadvantage of not really having a clear number one after the Dalvin Cook situation, but better depth than many teams might have had had they lost their starter.
Yeah, for sure. On the defensive side of the ball for Minnesota, I mean, you think about the Vikings defense, and when they're playing at their best, they are assaulting other quarterbacks is probably the appropriate verb in terms of what they do with their pass rush. That was not really the case in this game. They got a fair amount of pressure against a Washington offensive line that's certainly beat up by injuries. A lot of guys played, but they weren't 100%, but didn't get a sack until the final snap of the game, I believe, for Kirk Cousins. His last drop back of the game, Daniel Hunter finally got him for a sack. But one sack, five knockdowns. Do you think they can win and play effectively on defense without having a dominant pass rush? And certainly you figure Everson Griffin's going to be back, but just in case his foot injury is a little more serious and a little more lingers on a little more, perhaps, than it seems at this point of the year.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, and I think they got a little bit of pressure yesterday that maybe didn't register in the stats, but Mike Zimmer got a real good idea, I think, of where his pass rush stands without Everson Griffin. Maybe he overestimated it. Maybe. You know, and this was the feeling amongst a lot of people in Minnesota was that Everson was going to play. And so maybe he didn't really have a great in-depth idea of what he would do differently scheme-wise if he did not. But I think what Mike Zimmer saw yesterday was that without Everson Griffin, he might have a hard time getting that front four pressure. And so the good thing is for them, they have scheme. They have a lot of stuff within their scheme that they can adjust to if they need to. We all know they have plenty of zone blitzes. They have plenty of ways to disguise what they're about to do. And he'll probably need to employ more of that to get a pass rush on, say, this week of Jared Goff, if Everson Griffin, you know, and it doesn't play. And while he may end up playing, it's very much worth watching how a foot injury is going to affect a guy, a speed pass rusher like Everson Griffin, when he not only has to run fast, but he has to push off of that foot too. So it's reasonable to think they're not going to get the full Everson Griffin treatment here for a little while, whether he's on the field or not. And it'll be on Mike Zimmer to come up with some schematic adjustments, I think, to get that rush that they need to get in order to play the kind of defense they want.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like with the Vikings now at this point, they're not guaranteed a postseason spot. I don't think that's fair to say, but they're in great shape of making the postseason.
Yeah.
89.2% per the Football Power Index. So you'd figure they want to rest Griffin. They don't want to, you know, stress him out before they get to the postseason. You want to have him as close to 100% as possible. And you'd figure with the, you know, Daniel Hunter, with Tom Johnson, with the ability to rush Anthony Barr, you know, off the edge occasionally, you'd figure they have enough options to get pressure, even if they have to rush five more frequently than they would with Griffin in the lineup. In terms of that playoff percentage, 89.2%, let me ask you, I mean, is there a team you think that the Vikings on the NFC side, that the Vikings don't match up well with when it comes to the teams they're possibly going to play in the first couple rounds of the playoffs?
Well, even a few weeks ago, I might have said a team like the Rams that can score a lot of points, because I wouldn't have been convinced that this Vikings offense could score a lot of points without Sam Bradford and without Dalvin Cook. But geez, have they figured out ways to do that despite the losses of those people, and even with their offensive line not being totally healthy until yesterday. I think I'm just kind of running through it. You know, they've always had an issue with Seattle. You know, I don't know where Seattle is going. And to put their injuries, but they've at various times throughout the past few years had a hard time matching up with them. And so I could see, you know, even a week in Seattle giving them a pretty hard time, and having a, you know, especially depending on where that game is played. So that's the team that jumps out to me. But who knows if Seattle will even be in the playoffs when it's all said and done.
Yeah, it does seem like that. Just the what's the word I'm thinking of? The emotional baggage, to some extent, of playing the Seahawks can't feel very fun for the Vikings.
No. On the flip side, maybe I'm applying a little bit of that myself.
I think it's fair.
Team that came up.
I mean, I think that's fair. In terms of Washington, on the flip side, I haven't talked about them very much. They're in rough shape at this point. 4-5, 4.5 games back of Philadelphia in first place in the NFC East, given the tiebreaker situation. They've now lost to the Vikings, who, if the Vikings don't win the division, of course, they would be in line for a wild card spot, which would be a tough loss for Washington. They have beat the Rams, which helps, but lost to the Cowboys, lost to the Eagles, and not looking good for them. 4.4% chance of making the playoffs for the Football Power Index. Is there any reason to think that this team is going to go on the sort of run they went on a couple of years ago to, last time it was winning the division, but that sort of run to hopefully eke into the playoffs?
Well, they're kind of like a typical Washington team in that you can see how they could win a lot of games. I mean, you can, like, it's like all there, but it never gets pulled together, and that's like an annual thing to me of watching the Redskins. Like, you can see that they've got some playmakers on defense, and you can see that they have an upper echelon quarterback and some weapons that he can throw to, and some running backs who can make a difference. But it just never, ever, for whatever reason, that franchise has been so discombobulated for so many decades that it never really comes together. And so, to me, if they're going to make a run, it's going to have to be super Kirk Cousins playing out of his mind, doing what he did in Seattle every week for the rest of the year. And then hopefully that would be enough. And even then, who knows? But that to me, like with all the other things swirling around with their injuries and some of the other things going on there, that's really the only conceivable way that I could see that they get to the postseason, is that if Kirk Cousins just goes from being a, whatever you want to call him now, B+, A- starter to an A++ starter, and just literally carries them the rest of the way. And if he can do that, you know, he'll be buying islands in the Pacific for the rest of his life. But that, to me, would seem to be where it would need to go.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine them doing anything else. Their running game just hasn't been effective all season. The defense, and there have been some great individual performances. Zach Brown's been very solid, but Josh Norman isn't really playing all that well, to be honest. He was really exposed a lot during this game by both Diggs and Thielen, to be honest. So some concerns there. And the other part for Washington that's a real nuisance is that they're 4-5, and they're traveling this Sunday to New Orleans to play the Saints, who we should get to next because they are certainly one of the most intriguing and surprising teams of this NFL season. They are now 7-2. I believe they've won 7 straight games after losing the first two to Minnesota and New England. And it keeps getting more impressive. And they blew out the Bills, who are a legitimate playoff contender in the AFC, 47-10 in Buffalo. And wasn't like a fluke performance. It wasn't like if a couple of breaks had gone the Bills' way, the game would have gone totally differently. It was a straight-up dominant performance from start to finish. So, I mean, just in terms of the bigger picture, is there any reason to think that the Saints aren't this team? Like, you know, maybe you figure, okay, their defense has been so bad for so long that after a couple weeks of playing defensive football that's really effective, you think, okay, well, it's still probably a fluke, but we've seen it for so long now that it seems like it has to be real.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that if there was something easily defeatable about it, that offense coordinators would have gotten there, and maybe that could still happen, but and it doesn't really necessarily translate into maybe the quantitative analysis as much as we like to do, but there's something about being able to run it down a team's throat like the Saints didn't just do yesterday. They probably did it better than they've done all year, but they've done it a lot of teams. To physically impose will that has some level of qualitative effect on the rest of the team, and I think that is definitely part. When you're what was it yesterday? They had an entire drive of just runs where they went 80, 90 yards on all runs the whole way through. Didn't throw one pass with future Hall of Famer Drew Brees at quarterback and scored a touchdown. I mean, there's something in football that translates into that spreads through all areas. And one thing that I think has always been underrated about Sean Payton is his ability when things are going well to sort of impose a swagger. And we all attributed it to Greg Williams during their old defensive coordinator during their Super Bowl run. But I think Sean Payton has a lot of that too. And again, swagger, not something easy to measure, but something that has, to me, some level of translation. And I think that half the battle is walking onto the field and knowing that you have an easily traversable path to victory, and for them, it's that we're just going to run the ball down your throat, and that's going to be pervasive for the rest of the way we play. And so I think that's what they're doing. And so it's a long way of answering that. Yes, I do think that this is who they are, and they're going to be a tough team to beat. And it's not like it was Super Bowl year when if you got them at home, you had no shot. But if you had them on the road, you had a pretty good chance. You know, this is a team that's been pretty good on the road, too. Amazing to think of when you go back to that week one game against Minnesota that you referenced. But that's really where they've come.
Yeah, for sure. And you think about their ability to run the football. Again, like there's definitely something to that. You figure where it is that, okay, we have this other, you know, we can do this to you, and we can walk on the field and know that if we need to, we're going to run the football and you're not going to be able to stop it. There definitely is some value to that, even if it's not quantitatively provable.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of managing their game, I mean, there's other ways they can beat you now, right? Like in years past, every game they won basically had to be a game where they got into a shootout and Drew Brees threw 40 passes and outscored the other team, and the defense hung on for dear life and maybe come with a turnover here or there to create a short field, and that was enough to win the game. Whereas now, I mean, they're not winning games throwing the football a ton. And it's not just that, oh, they're running in the fourth quarter thing. They are running it and holding on to leads, but they're running the ball in the first half too. Their run percentage is up on first and 10.
Yeah.
Their run percentage is up in the first half. I mean, they're not getting a ton out of Drew Brees, to be honest. And you look at the numbers closely, Drew Brees isn't playing all that well. I mean, this is really a team that's built around the defense and running the ball right now.
Yeah, and then it brings me back to a couple years ago with the Broncos and Peyton Manning, that they still, you know, assuming that they get the playoffs and they make a run, there'll be a game at some point where they'll need a veteran future Hall of Fame type mm-hmm. quarterback to get them to the finish line, and that's the role he'll be able to play. Whether his skills are diminished or they're just not using them because they don't have to, or defenses are for whatever reason focusing on him, I think that it will still come in quite handy to have him when they need to get to that finish line in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's not really throwing to his wide receivers anymore. Michael Thomas obviously still has a big role, and he had a season-high 117 yards and 10 targets today. But otherwise, you know, Coleman had one catch for 30 yards. Ted Ginn, one catch for 3 yards. It's really all to his running backs and to his tight ends. And
yeah, they seem to devalue that a little bit with the Brandon Cooks trade.
Yeah, and to their credit. I mean, that's what the Patriots are doing, too, even though they traded for Cooks. So we'll get to that Broncos game a little later. All they did was throw to their running backs and their tight ends and take advantage of the weak spots in coverage for those teams. The Bills mm-hmm. are very sound at cornerback. Tre'Davious White is playing very well, so doesn't surprise me that they did that. And on the flip side of that, though, I'd say I think it's fair to be worried about the Bills' run defense without Marcell Dareus. And granted, I'm not saying he is, like, single-handedly the best run defender in the history of football, but you look over the last 2 weeks.
He's a big guy.
Yeah, I mean, the Jets last week, 41 carries for 194 yards. This week from the Saints, 48 carries for 298 yards on the ground. Yeah.
And a large percentage of that off tackle, in between the tackles, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And that's just, you know, you don't want to say, hey, they shouldn't have traded Dareus because that contract was onerous. They didn't think Dareus was a good fit in the locker room. They did want to move on. They were waiting for that deal. And I think, honestly, I can't fault them for making the trade, but there is an on-field impact of losing a player as good as Marcell Dareus. And for all we hear about chemistry and team culture and how valuable that is, and to be fair, it is, and that is meaningful, you know, you're seeing the short-term effects here. The Bills just aren't holding up against the run whatsoever.
Right, and they, you know, clearly they went into the season with a plan to stop the run, and that included Marcell Dareus. And some teams have, you know, a situation where you can just plug another guy in, or have somebody that were grooming for a job for a player who's going to be lost for free agency. But I think it's clear that in this case the Bills did not. It left a hole there, and they'll have to figure it out. You know, Leslie Frazier, who's their defense coordinator, has a pretty good scheme, but hasn't necessarily had a reputation for being one to make wholesale in-season adjustments to those mm-hmm. schemes. And so that might be something that they need to look at in the offseason. And, you know, for better or for worse, maybe they weren't as prepared for the short-term pain as some other teams might have been. But in the long term, like you said, I think that was the right call. Whether they were going to make the playoffs with Marcell Dareus, I'm not sure anyway. Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt that there's been a weakening there.
Yeah, for sure. They're still in decent shape. I mean, they're competing for
sixth
spot.
Yeah,
with the Bills and the Ravens and the Raiders and Dolphins, I guess. It's a real ugly final wild card spot there.
Nobody wants that spot right now.
It really feels that way, right? And then from the Bills' perspective, an ugly game from Tyrod Taylor, not his best performance by any means, even though the Saints' defense was playing very well. 9 of 18 for 56 yards and an interception. Bills were not able to run very early. They were okay running the ball early, but once they got down, they had to throw and weren't very effective. The Bills did bring in Nathan Peterman late in the game, and he was 7 of 10 for 79 yards and a touchdown. Of course, that was down literally 44 points, and afterwards, Sean McDermott did give a vote of confidence to Tyrod Taylor. It does seem like, you know, I'm not going to say he played well in this game, but it seems like they're so ready to move on from Tyrod Taylor, and it just does not seem to add up given, you know, their other options on the roster.
Yeah, I was surprised it actually came up. I mean, obviously they were losing bad and he didn't play great yesterday, but I was surprised it came up. Like, you know, I don't think it's that unusual to put a backup quarterback into a route, you know, and just say, you know what, you know, we're done here. Let's not get anybody hurt. Let's just, you know, get through it and move on. And so, like, I was surprised that the reaction, you know, was really like, does this mean that they might start Nathan Peterman next week? Because that didn't seem like that out of the ordinary to see it. But the interesting thing is, like, we're now on an entirely different regime with Tyrod Taylor, and we're not seeing an entirely different reaction to him from this mm-hmm. group as we did from the previous group. You know, everyone is entitled to their own individual opinion and how things work, but if you start stacking similar opinions from different people on top of each other, then you wonder, well, maybe there's something to it. So mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, he certainly hasn't played well enough for people to start trying to estimate whether he's going to make $24 million next year or $29 million or $30 million. Is he going to be the highest paid player in history? It's not like he's played that well enough to start those conversations. But as has been pointed out with him so many times, when you look around at the alternatives, you know, his value tends to increase by inference, I guess. And and so, but in the end of the day, it is instructive to see that there's been, to me, from the outside, muted enthusiasm from this general manager coaching group for him, which is not entirely different from what we saw previously.
Certainly true. So let's finish up with this, and we'll have to break. I mean, is there anything you think, if we're having this conversation in August, and I come back from the future and I tell you, hey, Kevin, I've time traveled into the past to tell you that the Saints defense is actually good this season, genuinely good, no mathematical, tricks, no secrets, no, they haven't invented any sort of, they haven't used time travel themselves to stop plays. It's only me using it. Is there anything which would have surprised you more in August? Like, is the Rams offense being great more surprising perhaps than the Saints defense being good? Cause it seems like I can't imagine.
Well, I guess the reason that maybe the Rams offense wouldn't have been as much of a surprise is because you could see a path towards a new guy with some bunch of new ideas, and an offensive line that from afar looked better, putting something together that people couldn't catch up to right away. And so that's why I would think the Rams would at least be conceivable. But having seen the Saints for so many years with so many bad defenses, and each year hearing how they signed these guys or drafted these guys, and this was their focus, and Sean Payton really thinks they got it figured out now, I would have said, well, that just sounds like the same story we've heard from ever. So I can't imagine something that I would have thought was a more surprising turnaround than that.
Me neither. And I mean, it's not even like with the Jags, for example, a lot of young talent there, and they've been remarkably healthy on defense for the Jags. I think their top 14, 15 guys now, including Darius, have all stayed healthy without missing any games. And for the Saints, I mean, they're down Delvin Bro, who's done for the year, didn't play all year. He's their number one cornerback, presumably when healthy.
Right.
They were without Nick Fairley, who re-signed with them and then had heart issues that prevented him probably from playing ever again, but certainly has cost him his season. And even on Sunday, they lost A.J. Klein, who's been great for them at inside linebacker. Yeah. And, Manti Te'o came in for the last three quarters, and he was totally fine. They didn't skip a beat. So it is really surprising to me. I still, I wrote about it. I certainly, the numbers back it up. The talent's there. The coaching is there. Every week, I'm still like, okay, this is the week where, the bloom is going to come off the rose, but they keep doing it to their credit, and they've really been very impressive this year. We're going to get to more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment, but we're going to hit our break back right after this. But first, guys, let's say that before the season, you were a Cleveland Browns fan, and you really wanted to try and pick a home game they were going to win. You should go see. You might have chosen this Sunday's game with the Browns and the Jaguars. You figure, okay, the Jags have a solid defense, but Blake Bortles is bad. They're not going to put things together. And you figure, well, the Browns actually may have a decent shot at winning the game. So maybe you bought a bunch of tickets to that game, and things haven't gone the way you hoped. The Jags are 6-3. The Browns are 0-9. Didn't look especially good for most of the game against the Lions on Sunday. And now you're stuck with tickets that you are perhaps a little nervous about. Maybe it's the flip side. Maybe you're a Jags fan in Cleveland. Maybe you weren't going to go to that game because you figured, well, I don't want to watch my team lose. I can go to Jacksonville if I want that to happen. Good news is, now you have the opportunity to go see the Jaguars play the Browns, and you can pay as little as $7 to go do it with our partners at SeatGeek. Because what SeatGeek does for sellers, and especially for buyers, is create a marketplace where people can find tickets for solid value, for great value, depending on where you want to sit. If you want to sit on the 50-yard line, if you want to sit in a distant, far-off part of the stadium, have an entire section to yourself, SeatGeek can accommodate all those different weird tastes because SeatGeek does the best job of aggregating tickets from all over the web and using their deal score technology to rate those tickets so you know you're getting a good deal. And even better, if you want to use SeatGeek for the first time to get tickets to the Jags-Browns game, really to any game that you're trying to see over the course of the NFL season, you can do that on SeatGeek and get $20 off your first purchase. To do that, download the SeatGeek app, and enter in my promo code, which is Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. And if you do that, you're going to get $20 back when you make your first SeatGeek purchase. So, like I said, whether it's Browns, Jags, whether, hopefully for your sake, it's a more entertaining game with two better football teams, no matter what game you want to see, you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase by using promo code Barnwell today. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined by Kevin Seifert of ESPN. We are recapping Week 10 of the NFL season. And let's get to what might have been the marquee matchup of the earlier games. And again, it did not go, I think, the way that a lot of people were expecting. Cowboys-Falcons, which was the Adrian Claiborne show.
Yeah, that talk about things coming out of nowhere surprising mm-hmm. you. I don't know that too many people would have had Adrian Claiborne coming up with 5 or 6 sacks or however many it ended up being in that game or any game. He has been a guy that has not been heard from too often since his rookie year.
Yeah, 6 sacks for Adrian Claiborne in this game. 1 as a spy, where, you know, I'm not going to lie, basically he tackled him at the line of scrimmage. I don't think it was a great pass rush move. Nice play in space to take down Dak Prescott, but then the 5 other sacks all passed backup Cowboys left tackle Chas Green, who was filling in for the injured Tyron Smith. The story heading into this game was that the absence of Ezekiel Elliott was going to cause the Cowboys to struggle on offense. I don't think the Cowboys missed him anywhere near as much as they missed their left tackle.
No. And, you know, so often we get into the weeds of wondering who to blame on when pass blocking goes bad. Was mm-hmm. it the fault of the lineman? Did the quarterback hold the ball too long? But when you see the same thing happening that many times, you don't even blame the players. Like, I honestly, like, that is one of the more derelict coaching situations that we've seen this year, in my opinion, from Jason Garrett, and I love Scott Linehan, but I don't know exactly what options he had in terms of scheme, but to allow the same thing to happen over and over again and not address it from a scheme perspective, you know, no team has 3 or 4 left tackles they can try mm-hmm. in any game. You're lucky if you have 1, let alone 2, and when that number 2 is there, you do the best you can with him, but to leave him on that island and to the complete lack of help and protection that he got was really appalling.
That's the crazy thing, right? Like, it'd be one thing if you had a tight end chipping over there, you had a running back who was helping out. It would stink if Adrian Claiborne still had 6 sacks, but he'd say, okay, well, we tried. Mm-hmm. They never adjusted. You watch that game, watch those sacks. I mean, it's the same thing over and over again. Yeah. It's a different style of pass rush here or there, spin move here or there.
Right.
But, I mean, it's one-on-one. And even on paper, you say, okay, well, it's Adrian Claiborne. We have to help on Vic Beasley's side. We have to, you know, rely on Chas Green to hold up one-on-one, and he's going to get better. It never happened. And like you said, it was really sort of staggering to see it just the Cowboys never change, whether it's to, you know, try reading him with the zone read, perhaps, try and create a running game, whether it's, you know, putting
roll
a tight end
out
on
away
side.
From him. Yeah.
Yeah, anything. They did a little bit of rolling out away from him, but they also didn't want to roll out to Beasley's side. So you had a thing where Dak Prescott really had nowhere to go, where it was, I'm going to say, trapped in the pocket. And even I think Dak Prescott's a very good quarterback. Even under that situation, you're just not going to have that many options. It really was surprising. Were you surprised at how well the Falcons offense played in this game?
No, because they've had their ups and downs. There's no doubt about it. But I have honestly not thought that the Cowboys defense was one that was so impenetrable that you shouldn't bother showing up at the field on a given day. Like, I think they feed off of the success they have offensively as much mm-hmm. as anything. And then Sean Lee gets hurt. And then you see, really good players on the Falcons making good plays. You know, Matt Ryan is still an excellent quarterback, despite the transition problems they've had in the Steve Sarkisian era at coordinator. Julio Jones was good enough to make plays, and Sanu was there and getting open. And so I wasn't totally shocked by it. I think it's not like they've been a horrendous offense even though they slipped. I mean, they slipped from the number 1 offense basically in the entire league, or 1 or 2 or 3, to somewhere in the middle of the pack. So I thought it was not entirely unpredictable that they would play the way they did yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, the absence of Sean Lee is one of the more telling numbers in all of football so far this season. When he's been on the field, the Cowboys have posted a passer rating of 85.6. Or Cowboys opponents have posted a passer rating of 85.6. With Lee on the sidelines, 107.8. They've averaged, 3.5 yards per carry with Lee at linebacker, and more than 5.5 yards per carry with Lee sidelined. And he missed most of this game. And even though the Falcons did lose Devontae Freeman to a concussion in the first quarter, I think on their first drive, maybe even the second play from scrimmage, they had no trouble moving the ball. There was, you know, stuff here and there, but Tevin Coleman looked just fine as the primary running back. They were effective throwing the football. Austin Hooper was 6 of 6 for 49 yards and a touchdown. I mean, the Cowboys, even with Jalen Smith, who was supposed to hopefully kind of take up some of the slack if Lee did get injured, which has been so frequent over the course of his career, I mean, they just don't have those sort of coverage linebackers and safeties to hold up against intermediate threats like the guys the Falcons have.
No, and you see examples of that every now and then through the NFL where you don't want to say that a team has built its scheme or put its hopes on one player, but when they're not on the field, you see the results. And, you know, for example, the Patriots, when there's no Edelman or Gronkowski on the field, and how things change so dramatically for them. And, you know, you see a few other situations at non-quarterback positions throughout the league. And so you would not, you know, people who aren't Cowboys fans or don't watch, there's a few of them, I suppose, out there. And the one or two people a week who don't tune in to watch the Cowboys each week that are still football fans might be surprised that some guy named Sean Lee is so critical to all the things that they do. But when he left yesterday, it was pretty pretty obvious difference.
Mm-hmm. It certainly was. And now you think about the Cowboys moving forward, they have, according to the Football Power Index, a 24.9% chance of making the postseason. Atlanta, on the other hand, is at 25.8%. If you had to pick one of those teams to make the playoffs right now, who would you pick?
Probably the Falcons. I mean, I guess something could change with this Ezekiel Elliott suspension because so many things have changed so far, but I'm assuming he's out for 6 games, and I don't like their chances in a lot of the games to win a lot of those games without him. And so, again, as you said, not wasn't the biggest issue in yesterday's game, but certainly was part of it. And over time, I think we've all seen the value of his presence. And so, you know, we'll see where the Falcons are in a really tough division. Mm-hmm. You know, you see what the Panthers are doing, and you see what we've talked about the Saints. But in terms of quality of team, I would probably lean Falcons right now to the Elliott-less Cowboys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Atlanta, of course, have a tough matchup this week. They're heading to Seattle, but maybe you figure they're catching Seattle at the right time with all those injuries. And then they still have 5 games in the NFC South to go, 2 against Tampa, 2 against New Orleans, 1 against Carolina. Yeah. So if they get hot, I mean, you know, they could get hot and then rise up the divisional ranks really quickly, whereas with the Cowboys, the schedule's not as tough. They have Los Angeles, Washington, New York, Oakland, Seattle, Philadelphia to end the season. And then next week, they have probably their biggest game of the season, you'd figure, at home against the Eagles, where if they lose that game, they're 5-5. The Eagles, I believe, would be 9-1. It might be too tough for them to come back from. It's almost a must-win game with 7 weeks left in the season.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way the suspension works out, that Ezekiel Elliott could conceivably play in that second Eagles game.
Yes.
But who knows if they'll even have a chance by then. And so you'd say, well, it's great. You know, if you're behind the division leader by a few games, it's great that you still have 2 games left against them. But they were probably stronger and in better position to play the Eagles earlier in the year than they will be now.
Absolutely. Let's finish up with the night game, Patriots and Broncos, which I keep checking during our podcast to see if the Broncos have fired special teams coordinator Brock Oliver. They haven't yet. Now, they may do that by the time we release this podcast a little later on today. But
Mountain time, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They may not have woken up yet. It does seem like, you know, realistically, if you were ever going to get a special teams coordinator fired at halftime of a game, it would have been last night for what we saw from the Broncos special teams during the first half. A muffed punt that resulted in a Patriots touchdown, a blocked punt that set up a field goal, a kickoff return that was allowed for a touchdown by Deion Lewis. 17 points from 3 special teams mistakes in the first half. And I don't know if the Broncos are going to win this game either way. Even with those points, they still would have lost 27-16 or 24-16 if you take those off the board. But their margin for error at this point is so slim that when they do stuff like that, they have no chance at winning, it feels like.
No, and a couple of things jump out. I guess, the muff there, a lot of teams get that, and I'm not sure if that's a result of coaching or not, but the coverage, and to get a punt blocked means you had a fundamental breakdown in blocking. And these guys have a timing down to the point where even if somebody beats their block, they're usually not going to get in there in time to get the kick. So if you block a punt, it means nobody blocked you, or basically somebody whiffed. Mm-hmm. And that's the coaching. And then that return was just to see the feeble attempts at tackling on that one was pretty surprising also. So that was not a great reflection at all. And so to me, in the larger sense, it goes to speaking more, and not that the Broncos defense has been lights out this year or last night, but the continuing waste of what is still a pretty good asset, whether it's because of lack of offense or now lack of special teams and lack of offense, is really, I don't want to go so far as to say criminal because it happens, but they will really go. I think the Broncos will ultimately look back at this era and think, gosh, how did we not get more done with the level of defense that we played for a long time? And that's too bad, because as much as the game is focused on offense and quarterbacks and passing and all that, as they showed the year they won the Super Bowl, there's lots of ways to be really good, and to have an elite defense is certainly one of them. And all you need is just a simple cooperation from the rest of the team. And over the past couple of years, they have not come close to getting that.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, it'd be one thing if, the Broncos were, if this were years past, where the Broncos had the number one defense in all of football by just about any measure you could come up with. They did enough on defense to prop up a mediocre offense. The special teams were okay, I guess, in years past. I don't think they were notably good or bad from what I remember. Certainly not as bad as they've been this year, even before the Patriots game. But when they were the number one defense in football, they were able to hold up. They were able to win so many games on their own that the offense just had to basically hop along and not turn over the ball five times to produce a victory most weeks. And now their defense is still really good. It's not number one. I think they were in the top 10, if I'm not mistaken, heading into the week of DVOA. They were sixth, which I think is fair, given how they've performed. They haven't been great the last 2 weeks, but they've been playing, of course, the Eagles and the Patriots, who make a lot of teams look bad on defense. Mm-hmm. But when their defense is not, they're sort of like the opposite of the Falcons in that when last year when the Falcons' offense was incredible, that was enough to prop up a mediocre defense. And then in the playoffs, when the defense got good, then suddenly they were a juggernaut and they were a team to be really scared of. With the Broncos, the issue with the Falcons, the offense is still good, but it slipped just enough that they can't prop up a really mediocre defense. For the Broncos, it's the opposite. Their defense has slipped from being incredible to merely being very good, to being a top 10 defense as opposed to a top one or top two defense. And so their offense has not been able to make up the strides to account for the defense slipping a bit. And as easy as it is to blame Brock Osweiler for that, I don't know that he was the problem with this team last night.
No, and when you look at what they've gotten a quarterback for the entire, really for the past 2 years, he certainly hasn't been any worse than what they've got, or certainly didn't play last night any worse than what they've had before that. I don't think he was the problem. When you're talking about an otherwise, as you mentioned, if the defense slips a little bit, then you need somebody playing at a little bit of a higher level at quarterback to kind of add to compensate, and they certainly haven't gotten that either. So it's incredible to me that they're in this position where he's the quarterback in the first place. A guy that they had no intention of ever bringing back, but he gets cut because the Browns are willing to pay him $15 million or $16 million, whatever it is, to not be on their team, and that's the only reason they end up picking him up. And to think that a guy who is regarded that poorly ends up in Denver and being the starting quarterback for a team with still a top 10 defense is a pretty incredible turn of events. Some related to injury, but some not. And so that is something to consider as well.
Mm-hmm. And this offense should probably be better than how they've been performing. I mean, this is a team that you say, okay, well, what haven't they invested in that they needed to invest in? They have two legitimately very good wideouts in Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders, who lit Malcolm Butler on fire for most of the game last night. They have a first-round pick at left tackle in Garrett Bowles. They have a very good center in Matt Paradise. They spent big money on Ronald Leary this year, and he's been good this year. They signed Manelik Watson, who hasn't been healthy and is on IR now at this point. They have CJ Anderson, who they spent a lot of money to retain as a running back. And they used a first-round pick on Paxton Lynch, who it looks like is likely to enter the starting lineup as early as next week against Cincinnati if he's healthy. But, of course, little reason to think he's going to be any good, given that he couldn't beat out Trevor Siemian for the job and hasn't looked good when he's been an injury fill-in in years past. So, I mean, I don't know what the next step is. They replace the offensive coordinator once Gary Kubiak retired with Mike McCoy coming in. I mean, I don't know.
It makes you wonder if they're not going to be back at the quarterback thing this offseason, honestly.
They have to
be. I mean, when you consider it from the perspective that you just laid out, with the personnel at all the different positions, I think Mike McCoy, you can say what you want about him as a head coach, has had a pretty good reputation as an offensive coordinator, and that leaves one spot, the quarterback. And so, maybe Paxton Lynch sets it on fire, but I don't know if they can afford to go into another season with the hope that Paxton Lynch, based on no evidence, can become their starter. They did trade up to get him, but wasn't like he was a top 10 pick or, it's completely inflexible relative to the rest of their franchise's needs. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, given all the other things that they already have in place, I wonder if they can really afford to be self-satisfied at that position in the offseason.
Right. But then, what if you're John Elway, what do you do? You don't really have the cap space necessarily to go out and spend $20 million on a quarterback. And I guess theoretically they could have Kirk Cousins fall into their lap or something, or Drew Brees could become a free agent and they could get that. Eli might be a free agent and could be a plausible a plausible addition for a team that
worked once, another time.
You'd figure, right? There has to be.
Yeah, it works.
Something has to happen very clearly, and they don't have a ton of leeway to work with in terms of finding a quarterback. So I can't really fault Vance Joseph and this staff right now, and I think there may be over the next few weeks a sort of public outcry for them to replace the head coach, to replace the offensive coordinator. And I think this one's on Elway. I do think that they ended up with a quarterback situation that just doesn't support the roster they have.
And we'll find out. There's been a fair bit of discussion and analysis about John as to whether he takes any blame for decisions that are made and whether he considers that some of the moves that he made are actually the causes of some of the problems that they've had, or whether he's willing to continue churning through coaches and churning through quarterbacks and churning through, iterations of what their short-term goals are, or if he's willing to sit tight with the coaching staff and sit tight with the rest of the short-term plan and see if and admit that the quarterback decisions he's made have not been good. We'll see if that's where he's willing to go, or if he really doesn't think that, or if he thinks it but isn't willing to act on it, or some portions of all of the above.
Yeah. I don't think they should get rid of Elway by any means. I think that would be way too aggressive. I think he's done so many good things in Denver that you have to give him, a chance to really make a big investment in quarterback after the last investment on Peyton Manning worked out, I think it's fair to say, pretty well. But it does seem like the decisions that they've made, and they even offered Brock Osweiler $12 or $13 million a year to stay in Denver before he went to Houston. It could even be worse than it is right now. And the one thing you'd say, go ahead.
I'd say they're just a really interesting franchise to look at, because most people hold them up as a model franchise. They won a bunch of Super Bowls. They made the right hire. The legend and the quarterback legend to rebuild them, and he's done a great job. But the ownership situation is pretty unique in that really the person with the authority over John Elway is Joe Ellis, who was basically for many decades their business guy, who's now risen to the point where he sort of represents ownership and decisions. And so you're not dealing with Pat Bowlen making this decision or any level of history that you can go back and see, like, well, how did they make these decisions, or do they have quick triggers, do they have slow triggers, or what? Who is ultimately the reason why they make these calls? And so whenever you talk about the future of John Elway, you wonder who was in charge of deciding that, if anybody.
That's true, yeah. Elway certainly seemed to be the one at the heart of the decision to get rid of John Fox after those division titles in years past, and that worked out well, obviously, but there is a major question of who's making the day-to-day calls there. The one thing that you would say is a positive for the Broncos is that their schedule does get easier. I mean, obviously, last 3 weeks they've played the Chiefs, the Eagles, and the Patriots with two of those three games on the road. I think a lot of teams would struggle and look bad against those, possibly the three best teams in football by some measure so far this year. Next 5 weeks, they're hosting the Bengals and the Jets. They travel to play the Raiders, the Dolphins, and the Colts. You would figure they're in line to win at least two of those games, maybe even three. And if they don't, if they go 1-4, if they go 0-5, they're in serious trouble. But if they go 1-4 or even 2-3 and don't look very impressive, I think that's maybe the point where you start wondering about everyone's future and what sort of drastic changes they have to make, because it's one thing to lose to the Patriots, the Eagles, and the Chiefs. It's another to get shut out by the Chargers or lose to, you know, a team like the Jets or Dolphins.
Right. And so, they're kind of hitting the crossroads, you know, cliche crossroads / crux of their season, where we find out if they've hit a dip or if this really is who they are. And fortunately for all of us, we'll know pretty soon.
We certainly will. In terms of the Patriots, anything that really stood out to you in this game in terms of how they're performing? Certainly the defense has improved from the slow start to the year. Are they just, is this what we're going to expect from the Patriots moving forward, or are there things to be concerned about perhaps over the remainder of the season?
I don't know. From the outside, it felt like this is what the Patriots always do this time of year. It's where they figured out whatever has kind of held them back early in the year, and they start getting on a roll where they have now identified their strengths. They have have enough tape to know what the weaknesses of their opponents are, and they're ready to attack. And so this felt like sort of the beginnings of that, if not the continuance of that yearly trend that we see. I think they're pretty strong right now. We talked earlier about getting backup quarterbacks into the game. To think that the Brian Hoyer finished that game and where they almost never did that for Jimmy Garoppolo, you know, whether that was because of they didn't often have big leads, or they just are feeling really good about themselves right now. That to me was a symbolic and interesting insertion into the game yesterday. And it really felt like they are in a very good place, schematically, personnel wise, and just from a team perspective. So I didn't see, not too much to me stood out to them in terms of things to be worried about. And I really think they're ready to make a big run here in the second half.
Does feel like that. I mean, outside of Malcolm Butler's struggles against Emmanuel Sanders, they really felt like a complete performance, and that they weren't even, you know, I feel like they had another gear they didn't have to touch in this game, just because they were so effective on special teams. They were so, you know, so efficient moving the ball on offense. You know, they just, it wasn't really a concern for them. It felt like they were operating at, you know, something short of their maximum output over the course of the game. Kevin, thanks so much for coming on. Where can people check out more of your stuff at ESPN?
On the NFL page or at on Twitter. I usually try to tweet those things out at Seifert, at Seifert ESPN.
What have you done the past week? You've had a couple interesting things pop up on the site.
Yeah, I've been trying to keep a decent eye on the playoff picture. I also did a story last week talking to some players of Polynesian descent about amid this ongoing question about how NFL players should be dealing with pain and amid the opioid crisis and amid a lot of players on the marijuana bandwagon, which unfortunately remains illegal for most of them. How can they address this pain? And Polynesian players use something called kava, which is a cultural drink in the South Pacific that's made out of a root. But it's also kind of hooking on, catching interest of all the American hipsters. And so there's a bunch of kava bars popping up on the East Coast especially. And it's something that is a very natural, legal, and from all perspectives, very safe product that can help relieve pain and help help anti-inflammatory, and also sort of just be a team booster as well. You know, a lot of the Polynesians will sit around after games or after practices and drink kava in the locker room and just kind of hang out. And so I just thought I'd get into something a little bit off the beaten path there, and seems especially topical in the second half of the season when pretty much every NFL player is trying to figure out how to get through the pain that they're suffering through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting piece. So definitely check that out. And Kevin, thanks so much. I'll be back on later on during the year.
Cool. Thanks for having me this time, Bill.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for checking out today's episode of the show with Kevin Seifert. You can check him out on Twitter. He is at Seifert ESPN. That's what I thought it was, but I needed to type in and just double check before I said that out loud. But he is at Seifert ESPN. Give him a follow. Really insightful during NFL games. And of course, more audio coming to you later this week. I'll be doing the Nickel Package on Wednesday, as I always do. And then another episode of the Bill Barnwell Show, previewing week 11, coming later on this week. So more audio for you later on.